Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the LA Steel Show.
I'm Lila.
And Leo is here.
I almost said I was Lila.
I know. I thought, oh my goodness, he's confused.
So he's picking up there.
And tonight we have a very good show for you, I think. We have, well, of course, we'll bring you some up to the date news, but we also have a great interview with the author of a book.
Yeah.
And what is the name of that book, Leo?
A Terrible Mistake.
Yeah.
And it's by Hank Arborello.
Arborelli.
Sorry.
Hank
Arborelli.
Junior.
I'm screwing up here.
His name is Hank Arborelli Junior.
Yeah.
A Terrible Mistake, and it's about some of the events that happened in the 50s that were unexplainable at the time. And he goes into and figures out what happened, and it involves secrets, and it involves brainwashing and trying to motivate people to do things they ordinarily wouldn't want to do, like through brainwashing and other techniques.
Yeah.
And it's a very interesting book, and it really is in about four parts, would you say, Leo?
It's in, it's four actually.
Almost like four books in one.
Yeah, it's the book's about 800 or 900 pages, I believe. So, it's up there. And
I think you're going to find the interview interesting. He was easy to talk to and chock full of information and stuff that, you know, is fascinating to hear about. A little bit scary, too, so... And we'll bring that to you at 8:30.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, we'll bring you some news.
Okay. Excuse me, I just had to yawn here.
Obama to block release of incriminating photos. I don't know what that means.
There's that one, and there was one on top, too. Obama administration will accept no more public input for a federal strategy that could prohibit U.S. citizens from fishing the nation's oceans, coastal areas, Great Lakes, and even inland waters.
Yeah, I had already read it.
No, you didn't.
Yeah, you had the article yesterday.
We didn't read it.
No.
And I didn't have it.
Oh, I read it somewhere. I don't know where.
This announcement comes at this time when the situation supposedly still is fluid and the interagency ocean policy task force still hasn't issued its final report on zoning uses of these waters. That's a disappointment, but not really a surprise for fishing industry insiders who have negotiated for months with officials at the Council on Environmental Quality and bureaucrats on the task force. These angling advocates have come to suspect that public input into the process was a charade from the beginning. And try to prohibit people from fishing, for crying out loud. When the World Wildlife Fund, an international fund for animal welfare, completed their successful campaign to convince the Ontario government to end one of the best scientifically managed big game hunts in North America, spring bear, the results of their agenda had severe economic impacts on small family businesses and the tourism economy of communities across northern and central Ontario. This is the director of...
Now we see NOAA, which is the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and the administration planning the future of recreational fishing access in America based on a similar agenda of these same groups and other green anti-use organizations through an executive order by the president. The current U.S. direction with fishing is a direct parallel to what happened in Canada with hunting. The negative economic impacts on hardworking American families and small businesses are being ignored. In spite of what we hear daily in the press about the president's concern for jobs and the economy, and contrary to what he stated in June order creating this process, we have seen no evidence from NOAA or the task force that recreational fishing and related jobs are receiving any priority. So it's kind of, you know, same.
Yeah, unless more anglers speak up to their congressional representatives, so their input will be considered. It appears the task force will issue a final report for marine spatial planning by late March. that's this month, and President Barack Obama then could possibly issue an executive order to implement its recommendations.
So I think
this sucks big rocks because I mean a lot of this is for recreational fishermen as well as looks like for commercial fishermen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not to fish their own waters.
Yeah.
Or the Great Lakes. I mean, what the hell is that crap?
It's a long article.
Yeah, but you know, this kind of thing is what is. I mean, you're taking this kind of thing away for green. It's absolutely insane. You know, it's totally insane. You know,
yeah.
They want to starve the people. They want to stop the people.
You can't even fish to catch
your own food, and you know, this is a crock of crap. You know, this has got to stop. This has got to stop. I mean, I'm all for saving the environment, but you know, to stop people from fishing or hunting recreationally
or growing your own food.
Right. I mean, when they're
by companies like Monsanto not allowing people to save their seeds.
Exactly. You know, it's just horrible.
It's about control.
It's total control of the food supply, and even that right next to you, people can't even go fishing. It's like this sucks rocks in the biggest way. So it's like, you know, if let me see if there's a way that you can fight this. I don't know. Go to best way to do it, outdoor salt water. Is that the whole thing? Like ESPN. I don't know if this is, I can't even tell you what
it's from
this
ESPN.
Website is it?
Yeah, it's what it says at the top.
No, that's just, yeah, it is.
ESPN Conversations.
Okay, yeah, ESPN Conversations. Outdoors, saltwater. And you can go to Called Out is the article. Public input period for federal fishing. Oh, it has ended. So that's a good deal. We just found out about it today. It's posted today. So, I wish the fishermen good luck all over the country because it's not a kind of sad.
Okay. Obama to how about I'd like to read this. On Wednesday,
yes.
Obama said he would try to block. Wait a minute, we're waiting for it to come up, so be patient. On Wednesday, Obama said he would try to block the court release of photos showing U.S. troops abusing prisoners. The release, which was to be the result of a Freedom of Information Act request by the ACLU, had been reasonable in the final weeks of April, but today Obama chose to come out against the release. According to the Associated Press, out of concern that the pictures would further inflame anti-American opinion and endanger U.S. forces in Iraq and Afghanistan, Obama planned to block them. Obama intends to block the release of the photos because they may negatively impact American empire and American military adventures in Afghanistan and Iraq. General Ray Odierno, a prime architect of the surge in Iraq, and General David Petraeus influenced Obama's decision after informing the administration they were afraid the photos will cost American lives. Obama suggested that the photos had already served their purpose in the investigations of a small number of individuals, and the individuals who are involved have been identified and appropriate actions have been taken. Also, Obama made the argument that these photos were requested in this case are not particularly sensational, especially when compared to the painful images that we remember from Abu Ghraib.
When choosing to make a mockery out of his promise of transparency and accountability as one American of the ACLU.
As one member of the
ACLU. Put it, Obama is fine with contending that if information requested does not show something worse than said previous atrocity or does not show that something more inhumane happened, the information should not be released.
Even if the information would give further credence to the argument that the Bush administration tortured, which many in the corporate news media are still reluctant to outright accept as they continue to cling to the enhanced interrogation technique euphemism when discussing torture, the fact that it does not top the brutality of a batch of previous photos means that the ACLU's and the Freedom of Information Act request should not be fulfilled.
The ACLU released a response to Obama's decision, which was written by Anthony Romero, executive director of the ACLU.
That goes on for quite a while.
We'll go down as far as it goes.
Let's see how long. It might be too long to... That's quite a long article. I'll just go to the end. I'll show you. That's the whole article.
There's a whole conversation there, and it's across fire and testament.
Okay, we'll just read the response of the ACLU.
Okay. The Obama administration adoption of their stonewalling tactics and opaque policies of the Bush administration flies in the face of the president's stated desire to restore the rule of law, to revive our moral standing in the rule, and to lead a transparent government. This decision is particularly disturbing given the Justice Department's failure to initiate a criminal investigation of torture crimes under the Bush administration.
It is true that these photos would be disturbing. The day we are no longer disturbed by such repugnant acts would be a sad one. In America, every fact and document gets known, whether now or years from now, and when these photos do see the light of day, the outrage will focus not only in the commission of torture by the Bush administration, but on the Obama administration's complicity in covering them up. Any outrage related to these photos should not be due to their release, but to the very crimes depicted in them. Only by looking squarely in the mirror, acknowledging the crimes of the past, and achieving accountability can we move forward, ensure that these atrocities are not repeated. That's my concern.
Absolutely. And if Obama administration continues down this path, it will betray not only its promises to the American people, but its commitment to this nation's most fundamental principles. President Obama has said we should turn the page, but we cannot do that until we fully learn how this nation veered down the path of criminality and immorality, who allowed that to happen, and whose lives were mutilated as a result. Releasing these photos, as painful as it might be, is a critical step toward the accounting. The American people deserve no less. I fully agree to that.
I think all of this stuff should be exposed, and I think we should take ownership for it.
Right. Instead of burying it. They also have the transcript of Gibbs being asked questions on this, and it's quite long. It's for the, but I would recommend that you go to this site, and it is salon.com, I believe. No, I'm sorry. The article is from, I believe, salon.com, but it's. It's on Ken Gostola's site, G-O-S-Z-T-O-L-A blog, Gostola blog. And
that was written, wait a minute, I think that was written in May. Leo.
It was written May 14th, a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
So this thing.
Didn't know that he had blocked that.
We never knew that he had blocked it, no. This is something that just came out. It was released. So just so you know, something new. Put that up there.
Goldman sucks.
Huh.
Patients' medical records go online without consent. Oh, that's a serious thing.
Yeah.
Could you play that?
Want me to play this one?
Yeah.
It's good. I don't know, the Goldman Sachs, the Summers, and I don't know who that guy is, but Greenspan.
Greenspan's right.
Okay. It says Goldman sucks. So
the first thing you need to know about Goldman Sachs is that it's everywhere. The world's most powerful investment bank is a great vampire squid wrapped around the face of humanity, relentlessly jamming its blood funnel into anything that smells like money. Any attempt to construct a narrative around the former Goldmanites in influential positions quickly becomes an absurd and pointless exercise, like trying to make a list of everything. What you need to know is the big picture. If America is circling the drain, Goldman Sachs has found a way to be that drain, an extremely unfortunate loophole in the system of Western democratic capitalism, which never foresaw that in a society governed passively by free markets and free elections, organized greed always defeats disorganized democracy. They achieve this using the same playbook over and over again. The formula is relatively simple. Goldman positions itself in the middle of a speculative bubble, selling investments they know are crap. Then they hoover up vast sums from the middle and lower floors of society with the aid of a crippled and corrupt state that allows it to rewrite the rules in exchange for the relative pennies that the bank throws at political patronage. Finally, when it all goes bust, leaving millions of ordinary citizens broken starving, they begin the entire process over again, riding in to rescue us all by lending us back our own money at interest, selling themselves as men above greed. Just a bunch of really smart guys keeping the wheels greased. They've been pulling the same stunt over and over since the 1920s, and now they're preparing to do it again, creating what may be the biggest and most audacious bubble yet. The basic scam in the internet age is pretty easy, even for the financially illiterate to grasp. Companies that weren't much more than pot-fueled ideas scrawled on napkins by up-too-late bong smokers were taken public via IPOs, hyped in the media, and sold to the public for mega millions. It was as if banks like Goldman were wrapping ribbons around watermelons, tossing them out of 50-story windows, and opening the phones for bids. In this game, you were only a winner if you took your money out before the melon hit the pavement. It sounds obvious now, but what the average investor didn't know at the time was that the banks had changed the rules of the game, making the deals look better than they actually were. They did this by setting up what was in reality a two-tiered investment system, one for the insiders who knew the real numbers, and another for the lay investor who was invited to chase soaring prices the banks themselves knew were irrational. While Goldman's later pattern would be to capitalize on changes in the regulatory environment, the key innovation in the internet years was to abandon its own industry standards of quality control. Goldman's role in the sweeping global disaster that was the housing bubble is not hard to trace. Here again, the basic track was a decline in underwriting standards, although in this case, the standards weren't in IPOs, but in mortgages. By now, almost everyone knows that for decades, mortgage dealers insisted that homebuyers be able to produce a down payment of 10% or more, show a steady income and good credit rating, and possess a real first and last name. Then at the dawn of the new millennium, they suddenly threw all that shit out the window and started writing mortgages on the backs of napkins to cocktail waitresses and ex-cons carrying $5 in a Snickers bar. And what caused the huge spike in oil prices? Take a wild guess. Obviously, Goldman had help. There were other players in the physical commodities market. But the root cause had almost everything to do with the behavior of a few powerful actors determined to turn the once solid market into a speculative casino. Goldman did it by persuading pension funds and other large institutional investors to invest in oil futures, agreeing to buy oil at a certain price on a fixed date. The push transformed oil from a physical commodity rigidly subject to supply and demand into something to bet on, like a stock. Between 2003 and 2008, the amount of speculative money in the commodities grew from $13 billion to $317 billion, an increase of 2,300%. By 2008, a barrel of oil was traded 27 times on average before it was actually delivered and consumed. The history of the recent financial crisis, which doubles as a history of rapid decline and fall of the suddenly swindled dry American empire, reads like a who's who of Goldman Sachs graduates. By now, most of us know the major players, as George Bush's last Treasury Secretary, former Goldman CEO Henry Paulson, was the architect of the bailout, a suspiciously self-serving plan to funnel trillions of your dollars into handfuls of his old friends on Wall Street. Robert Rubin, Bill Clinton's former Treasury Secretary, spent 26 years at Goldman before becoming chairman of Citigroup, which in turn got a $300 billion taxpayer bailout from Paulson. Then there's John Thane, the asshole chief of Merrill Lynch who bought an $87,000 area rug for his office as his company was imploding. A former Goldman banker, Thane enjoyed a multi-billion-dollar handout from Paulson, who used billions in taxpayer funds to help Bank of America rescue Thane's sorry company. And Robert Steele, the former Goldmanite head of Wachovia, scored himself and his fellow executives $225 million in golden parachute payments as his bank was self-destructing. There's Joshua Bolton, Bush's chief of staff during the bailout, and Ed Liddy, the former Goldman director whom Paulson put in charge of bailed out insurance giant AIG, which forked over $13 billion to Goldman after Liddy came on board. The heads of Canadian and Italian national banks are Goldman alums, as is the head of the World Bank, the head of the New York Stock Exchange, the last two heads of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, which incidentally is now in charge of overseeing Goldman. But then, something happened. It's hard to say what it was exactly. It might have been the fact that Goldman's co-chairman in the early 90s, Robert Rubin, followed Bill Clinton to the White House, where he directed the National Economic Council and eventually became Treasury Secretary. Well, the American media fell in love with the storyline of a pair of baby boomers, 60-child Fleetwood Mac yuppies nesting in the White House. It also nursed an undisguised crush on Rubin, who was hyped as without a doubt the smartest person ever to walk the face of the earth, with Newton, Einstein, Mozart, and Kant running far behind. Rubin was the prototypical Goldman banker. He's probably born in a $4,000 suit. He had a face that seemed permanently frozen, just short of an apology for being so much smarter than you. And he exuded a Spock-like, emotional, neutral exterior. The only human feeling you could imagine him experiencing was a nightmare about being forced to fly coach. It became almost a national cliche that whatever Reuben thought was best for the economy, a phenomenon that reached its apex in 1999, when Reuben appeared on the cover of Time with his Treasury deputy Larry Summers and Fed Chief Alan Greenspan under the headline, "The Committee to Save the World," and what Reuben thought mostly was the American economy, in particular the financial markets, were overregulated and needed to be set free. During his tenure at Treasury, the Clinton White House made a series of moves that would have drastic consequences for the global economy, beginning with Reuben's complete and total failure to regulate his old firm during its first mad dash for obscene short-term profits. After the oil bubble collapsed last fall, there was no new bubble to keep things humming. This time, the money seems to be really gone, like worldwide depression gone. So the financial safari has moved elsewhere, and the big game in the hunt has become the only remaining pool of dumb, unguarded capital left to feed upon. Taxpayer money.
But wait, there's more.
Here in the biggest bailout in history is where Goldman Sachs really started to flex its muscle. It began in September of last year when then-Treasury Secretary Paulson made a momentous series of decisions. Although he had already engineered a rescue of Bear Stearns a few months before and helped bail out quasi-private lenders Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, Paulson elected to let Lehman Brothers, one of Goldman's last real competitors, to collapse without intervention. Goldman's superhero status was left intact, says market analyst Eric Salzman, and an investment banking competitor, Lehman, goes away. The very next day, Paulson greenlighted a massive $85 billion bailout of AIG, which promptly turned around and repaid $13 billion it owned to Goldman. Thanks to the rescue effort, the bank ended up getting paid in full for its bad bets. Immediately after the AIG bailout, Paulson announced his federal bailout for the financial industry, a $700 billion plan called the Troubled Assets Relief Program, and put a heretofore unknown 35-year-old Goldman banker named Neil Kashkari in charge of administrating the funds.
Hey, I don't think anyone questions, Mr. Kashkari, that you're working hard. Our question is who you're working for.
In order to qualify for bailout monies, Goldman announced that it would convert from an investment bank to a bank holding company, a move that allows it not only to $10 billion in TARP funds, but to a whole galaxy of less conspicuous publicly backed funding, most notably lending from the discount window of the Federal Reserve. And thanks to an obscure law allowing the Fed to block most congressional audits, both the amounts and the receipts of the monies remain almost entirely secret.
You cannot be serious!
Converting a bank to a holding company has other benefits as well. Goldman's primary supervisor is now the New York Fed, whose chairman at the time of its announcement was Stephen Friedman, a former co-chairman of Goldman Sachs. Friedman was technically in violation of the Federal Reserve policy by remaining on the board of Goldman, even as he was supposedly regulating the bank. In order to rectify the problem, he applied for and got a conflict of interest waiver from the government.
That was easy.
Friedman was also supposed to divest himself of Goldman stock after Goldman became a bank holding company. But thanks to the waiver, he was allowed to go out and buy 52,000 additional shares in his old bank, leaving him $3 million richer. Friedman stepped down in May, but the man now in charge of supervising Goldman, New York Fed President William Dudley, is yet another former Goldmanite. The collective message of all of this? The AIG bailout, the swift approval for its bank holding conversion, the TARP funds, is that when it comes to Goldman Sachs, there isn't a free market at all. The government might let other players on the market die, but it simply will not allow Goldman to fail under any circumstances. Its edge in the market has suddenly become an open declaration of supreme privilege. Now it's more of an explicit advantage. Fast forward to today. Having seamlessly navigated the political minefield of the bailout era, Goldman is once again back to its old business, scouting out loopholes in a new government-created market with the aid of a new set of alumni occupying key government jobs. Gone are Hank Paulson and Neil Kashkari. In their place are Treasury Chief of Staff Mark Patterson and CFTC Chief Gary Gensler, both former Goldmanites. Gensler was the firm's co-head of finance. And instead of credit derivatives or oil futures or mortgage-backed CDOs, the new game in town, the next bubble, is in carbon credits. A booming trillion-dollar market that barely even exists yet, but will if the Democratic Party that gave $4.5 million to the last election manages to push into existence a groundbreaking new commodities bubble, disguised as an environmental plan called cap and trade. The new carbon credit market is a virtual repeat of the commodities market casino that's been kind to Goldman, except it has its own delicious new wrinkle. If the plan goes forward as expected, the rise in prices will be government-mandated. Goldman won't even have to rig the game. It will be rigged in advance.
That's what he said. So anyway, we got you want to read that, or you want to read something?
Let's just say Alien Banks. Only answer one question.
Fundamental legal questions. She fails to answer. How can the Sun Spirit claim data or security with any confidence? No answer.
There's a video that you guys might want to go to.
Yeah, it's 5 minutes. But
yeah.
If you Washington Post on lunatic 911 conspiracy theorists.
Well, this might be good. An editorial in the Washington Post yesterday slammed Japanese Member of Parliament Yukushi Fujita because he seems to think that America's rendering of the events of September 11, 2001 is a gigantic hoax. His ideas about the terrorist attacks are too bizarre, half-baked, and intellectually bogus to merit serious discussion. Fujita, the editorial added, is a member of the lunatic fringe who have spawned a thriving subculture of conspiracy theorists at home and abroad, and his views, rooted as they are in profound distrust of the United States, seem to reflect a strain of anti-American thought. The piece closes by suggesting that the factor-averse Fujita should be removed from office. Let's see what...
Foreign policy, which is a globalist.
Among Fujita's bizarre views are the shadowy forces with advanced knowledge of the plot played the stock market to profit from it, the fantastic idea that 8 of the 19 hijackers are alive and well, and that controlled demolition rather than fire or debris may be more likely explanation for at least the collapse of the building at 7. Yet while serving out of hit piece against the global 9/11 truth movement, it is in fact the editors of the Washington Post who are demonstrably fact-averse. It happens to be an uncontroversial fact that in the days just prior to the attack, there was a dramatic increase in trade on put options, and what made this unusual spike even more mysterious, that it was observed only in relation to companies directly affected by the attacks, including United Airlines, American Airlines, and Morgan Stanley, Dean Witter and Company, which occupied 22 floors of number 2 World Trade Center. That this occurred was in fact mentioned in the 9/11 Commission report, which reported that the federal investigations into the suspicious trading concluded that it was all innocuous. Many of the trades on the airline companies, for instance, were traced to single U.S.-based institutional investor with no conceivable ties to Al-Qaeda. In other words, the report acknowledges that the suspicious trades did in fact occur, but dismisses them as evidence of foreknowledge because the investigation didn't lead to the proper predetermined culprits. This is illustrative of a kind of standard the 9/11 Commission employed throughout its so-called investigation. The fantastic idea that the identity of the hijackers named by the FBI is in question is an interesting case. At the time, the Washington Post had also subscribed to this half-baked notion. On September 20, 2001, under the headline, "Some Hijackers' Identities Uncertain," the Post reported, FBI officials said yesterday that some of the 19 terrorists who carried out last week's assault on the New York and Washington may have stolen the identities of other people, and their real names may remain unknown. Among the evidence for this, the Post cited Saudi government officials as having determined that at least 2 of the terrorists used the names of living, law-abiding Saudi citizens. The man in the picture of one of the alleged hijackers, the Post reported, was Salam al-Hamzi, who was actually alive and well, according to Ghaffar Al-Ghani, the chief of the Saudi embassy's information office in Washington. The real al-Hamzi's passport was stolen by a pickpocket on a trip to Cairo 3 years before. Another of the alleged hijackers was Abdulaziz al-Omari, who Allegheny said was also alive and an electrical engineer in Saudi Arabia. The uncertainty, the Post continued, highlights how difficult it may be to ever identify some of the hijackers who participated in the deadliest act of violence on American soil. Most of the hijackers' bodies were obliterated in the fiery crashes. The Washington Post was not the only mainstream media outlet to report on the uncertainty over the hijackers' identity. It was widely reported elsewhere, both in the U.S. and in international medias. The UK's Guardian, for instance, reported on September 21st under the headline "False Identities Mislead the FBI" that the FBI acknowledged yesterday that some of the terrorists involved in the attacks last week were using false identities with regard to al-Hazmi and al-Omari. FBI acknowledgement of this was also reported by the BBC the same day under the headline "FBI Probes Hijackers' Identities." The BBC also reported on September 22nd under the headline "Hijack Suspect Alive in Morocco" that Waleed al-Shahiri, another alleged hijacker, the same Mr. al-Shahiri whose photo the FBI had released as being among the terrorists, has turned up in Morocco, proving clearly that he was not a member of the suicide attack. On September 23rd, under the headline "Hijack Suspects Alive and Well," the BBC reported that yet another of the men named by the FBI as a hijacker has turned up alive and well, and that the identities of the four of the 19 suspects are now in doubt. FBI Director Robert Mueller also acknowledged that the identity of the several of the suicide hijackers is in doubt. The London Telegraph similarly ran a story on September 23rd entitled "Revealed the Men with Stolen Identities." The Washington Post itself ran a follow-up article on September 25th entitled "Some Light Shed on Saudi Suspects," reporting that the U.S. investigators believe they have positively identified 15 of the 19 hijackers. Are you ready for our interview, Lett? But the identities of the four were still in question. So this article goes on. It's very long, but it's a good one to read. Let me see what it says at the very end. The last paragraph says, "Surely the proper, credible investigations into the events of 9/11 should occur, indeed should have occurred a long time ago, should also be non-controversial no matter what conspiracy theory one believes, whether it belongs to the lunatic fringe or to the U.S. government." And that article was by Jerry Hammond, an independent political analyst and editor of the Foreign Policy Journal. The Dutch government wants to sell flu vaccines back to Big Pharma. We had played that a while ago.
I had never noticed what was going on.
Is it anti-Semitic to say Zionists control U.S. foreign policy? Let's see what this says. This isn't too long.
I went into the State Department Near East section and found there was not one single Palestinian, not one single Muslim, religious, Saudi, you know, Jordanian, not one Christian Protestant, not one Roman Catholic, not one plain old American, whatever, from Cornpunk. Every single person in all of those offices were either Zionists, Israelis, whatever, and they had pictures all over the wall of Israel, Israel, Israel. They had magazines, Israel Today. You know, I was given a copy of one. And there were yarmulkes, you know, and the Israeli writing. In other words, and I asked one of the women, after having gone through about, you know, four or five of these offices, I said, as I was pretending like I really, you know, wanted, I was just kind of wanting to know where the Palestinian office was, you know. She said, "Well, we handle all of that. We handle all of that."
And this is the State Department
the
Near East, the part that handles Israel, Jordan,
okay,
all of these.
Egypt.
Yeah, the Near East section. Yeah.
And we just totally dominated by.
Totally.
Israeli.
Totally. And at that time, the spokesman, I can't remember his name, he was a Zionist, the spokesman for the whole State Department.
Kind of unbelievable, huh?
That's kind of shocking.
Yeah, well, that's what's going on. Well, I mean, we don't, our foreign policy is totally Jewish, you know, it's totally Zionist, and nobody can break away from that, and that's why we're having the troubles we have. And why that's the case, I don't know. Why that has to be like that, I don't understand.
Yu-Gi-Oh! Occult Symbolism for Children. Yu-Gi-Oh! A Japanese manga created by Kazuki Takahashi. It has spawned into a franchise that includes television shows, trading card games, video games, and movies. This worldwide phenomenon has reached millions of fans across the world, but it is still widely unknown by outsiders. I came across Yu-Gi-Oh! The movie while randomly switching channels on Saturday morning. I have to say that the entire production was rather of mediocre quality.
Who helps spread the popularity of LSD?
I've, however, noticed that it caters to actual adepts of the card game and not to outsiders, as many of the scenes simulate card duels using actual cards for the Yu-Gi-Oh! Decks. So I did not understand much of the dialogue about spells and monsters during the movie, but I still found the plot and the symbolism of the storyline quite startling. Further research into the world of Yu-Gi-Oh! Only confirmed my doubts. Yu-Gi-Oh! Is permeated with secret society symbolism, notably of the Ordo Templi Orientis, an occult brotherhood popularized by Aleister Crowley.
Okay. So I think we've got this up now, and I'm going to hopefully have difficulty with this, trying to get exactly where it started here tonight. I don't want it.
To work at Edgewood Arsenal in Maryland, and they actually participate.
Just started there.
Yeah, I'm not sure if this is going to be the whole half hour, though. I can't seem to find the...
We'll just start it there. That's fine.
Okay. Right.
And the LSD experiments that were conducted there...
This is Hank Arborello. Arborelli, rather.
Which affected almost 5,700 troops that were there. All men. They had a rule where...
I remember that. I remember that. Coming
yeah, they didn't
out,
want to give LSD to women, but
right.
But it was okay to target 5,700 men, and with what they told them was sort of a trial drug.
You know, I can say this because this was quite a number of years ago, but I had a friend of mine who had come out of the military and come out of the Air Force, and he enjoyed acid. He said, and I said, "Well, why do you enjoy acid?" And he says, "Because it's the drug of choice in the Air Force." And I said, "Are you serious?" He says, "Yeah." He says, "It's the drug of choice in the Air Force." He says, "They're the Air Force, the ones that first used it and invented it." And he says, "It's great because it doesn't stay in your system for more than 24 hours or something."
That's correct. It has a 24-hour lifespan in your system, and it's almost within maybe 48 hours, all evidence whatsoever, the drug is gone. It doesn't even show up in urine test. That's not very encouraging that pilots...
No, he wasn't a pilot. Thank God. But I think he thought he was, but he wasn't.
Yeah.
And,
he was flying in different sorts of ways.
But he said it was common, very, very common, and he says it's a drug of choice for the Air Force.
During the 60s and early 70s, it was a drug that was basically everywhere in the United States, and in a lot of ways, we can thank the CIA for that, because a number of the people who helped spread the popularity of LSD were pretty prominent figures in the 60s, like Ken Kesey, the writer who wrote One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. He basically wrote that book while he was under the influence of LSD, because he was working at night as a janitor at a veterans hospital where the CIA was
Are you there?
Hello? I think we lost our connection.
Yeah, I lost that connection and I had to call him back. Bear with us.
Are you with us?
Something happened. Well, we'll try to call him right back. In the meantime, let me say that we were talking to Hank Alvarelli Jr. about his book, A Terrible Mistake, Who Killed Frank Olson, and about his investigations. On November 28, 1953, one of America's greatest mysteries occurred when an Army biochemist working with the CIA fell to his death from a hotel window in New York City. 22 years later, it was revealed that the scientist, Frank Olson, had been drugged with LSD before his death. In 1996, the New York District Attorney's Office opened a murder investigation into Olson's strange death, and the strangeness surrounding Olson's death only widened. Now the mystery is solved, and the truth will shock readers. Who murdered Frank Olson and why? What was the true nature of Olson's work for the CIA? And what did the CIA's secret mind control experiments have to do with Frank Olson? Hello, are you there with us again?
Yes, I'm back. I don't know what happened. Maybe we said something.
I don't know, but I said, uh-oh. I wanted to ask you, the atmosphere of fear and being afraid and all that generated in the 50s, you know, I remember going under the desk for the nuclear bomb scare and all that kind of thing. We have the same atmosphere being created with Al-Qaeda and terrorism. And is that another excuse for, do you think, for doing these terrible things to people who don't agree with us?
I think you said it in a nutshell. I think that's exactly what it is. It gives a very good excuse to basically, you know, do anything they want to do. And at the biggest level, to basically start to take rights away from people. As best example, through the Patriot Act, which I view as basically going against the Constitution.
Oh, here, we agree with you.
Yeah, I mean, you destroyed it you destroyed all the power.
Very much so.
Well, we're very concerned about this new bill that's being put forth by John McCain and Joseph Lieberman, the enemy belligerent interrogation.
I think everyone in America should be concerned with that. I don't, you know, the only thing people can really do is speak out. The best thing they can do is listen to shows like yours and educate themselves first, and then, you know, either call or write their congresspeople, or do both. The best thing to do is both, and just make it clear to those people that you're opposed to it.
Yeah, in 2007, they passed the Thought Crimes Bill. Remember that?
The what?
The Thought Crimes Bill.
No, I don't remember that at all.
Yeah, yeah. Our illustrious senators signed that as well, Lieberman and Dudd. But those two guys signed it, and the House signed it. I mean, I think it passed the House by 400 votes. And it was a thought crimes prevention bill, all right? And it was against hate thought. Anybody who has a hate thought or anybody who has a
right, yes, exactly.
Yeah, and it passed the House and the Senate. And it's like what that means is anybody who has a thought, all right, That's
they don't want anybody thinking at all.
Has committed a crime, you know.
Well, you're right, and if you read, a lot of people haven't even bothered to read the Patriot Act, but the Patriot Act, the wording in that is so loose that if you were to say something publicly like damn the government or something, that innocuous, you could basically be arrested for that, for saying something coercive against the United States government. That's how loose the language is. And, of course, if you're arrested today under the Patriot Act, you don't get arraigned right away and you don't go to trial right away. You could sit like Jose Padilla in a small cell for 3 or 4 years before anybody even thinks of you.
That's true.
And they don't have to inform anybody.
No, Nobody at all. Nobody at all. If you're declared, you know, what they would deem a threat to the federal government or an enemy combatant, whatever that is, your goose is cooked.
Yeah. Well, we're fortunate that we haven't been boiled yet. We've come out and said many, many things against the government here and against the system and against whatever, and we intend to keep doing so.
Well, that's good. It's always risky to try to speak the truth and to spread the truth around, but
we're fortunate. Yeah, we're very fortunate in the sense that we have the arresting officer can hear us. You know what I mean? So we have some voice, but it's like...
Well, you've certainly written a book that exposes a lot.
That's right. You exposed a tremendous amount of stuff going on there.
And, of course, the next step is, the leap that everybody takes is, well, what's happening to us now?
Oh, exactly. And that's what, I mean, as shocking as a lot of my book is, people shouldn't think that it's, you know, old history or ancient history at all. The same exact things are going on today. You just change the locations and the names. That's the same level of arrogance. I mean,
yeah.
Up until recently, people thought torture only started, you know, not long after 9/11, that we never tortured anybody prior to that, but... It's pretty clear to me after writing this book that torture was pretty common in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. I mean, we might have called it enhanced interrogation, but, you know, those are just code words for torture.
Yeah.
Well, it started a long time before that. There was the Spanish Inquisition.
That's right. That's where waterboarding came from.
Yeah,
was it really?
Absolutely. That's where it was first used.
And that also was done in the name of God.
That's right.
Poor God, he gets blamed for so many things.
That's right.
Yeah. So.
And it was done against the Muslims as well.
Mm-hmm.
Many Muslims.
Yes. It goes back to the.
God, isn't that weird, huh?
Yeah. It is. I mean, it's the same war that just comes back in different forms every 100 years or so.
Oh, yeah. I mean, 500, 600, 700 years now it's been since they...
it's certainly a reflection of the degree to which we haven't become civilized.
That's right.
It's really kind of sad. It's that comment on humanity. Not all of humanity, but certainly a certain segment of it. And
too much of it, though. I mean, we're supposed to be this pinnacle of democracy and the shining city on the hill stands for human rights, but I think we've slipped right a ways down the hill in the last 10 or 15 years.
And falling fast.
Pardon?
And we're falling fast.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, a lot of these things were perpetrated on non-Americans.
Mm-hmm.
What scares me is that these bills that are being passed apply to us.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
apply to everyone in this country, everyone in the world, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, especially anyone under our influence at all.
Mm-hmm. It's common now for the FBI and the CIA to go anywhere in the world to arrest people. Although we don't call it arresting anymore, it's just we rendition people, and you know if they're perceived to be a high-level risk, then we don't bring them into the United States. We'll send them to some country like Turkey or Egypt where there's no pretense about torture. They just start torturing them right away. and we don't even know what happens to 80 to 90% of those people that are picked up like that. It's conceivable that many are tortured to the point of death. And then they're just tossed out with yesterday's trash.
Well, do you remember this guy? It was a businessman, Iraqi businessman, and he's suing the government now.
Mm-hmm.
But he was picked up in some place off the street, brought to Uzbekistan, I think.
Yeah.
All right. Brutally tortured. All right. And then they found out he knew absolutely nothing about anything. And they flew him back and they flew him back to Iraq. And put him out in the middle of a field somewhere and said, find your way home. And the guy, I forget his name, but it's a case against the United States now. By this Iraqi citizen.
There are many cases like that. There was a case that came out about a month ago, a Canadian who was in the same situation. He'd been, I think, studying in Afghanistan, but he was a Canadian citizen, and somebody turned him in Afghanistan because at that point in time, if you turned somebody in as a terrorist or a member of Al-Qaeda, the United States government was paying $10,000 to $15,000 U.S. dollars.
Yeah.
Per head, and not asking any questions. Mm. So somebody said, well, this guy's from Canada, so we might as well turn him in, and it's not going to bother anybody around here. they held him.
That's true. That's absolutely true.
They held him. His family had no idea where he was for 2 years.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's terrible.
But anyway.
Well, you must be filled with all kinds of stories. And I wish we had time for more.
We'd like to have you back again.
I'd love to come back.
We enjoy talking to you tonight.
I spent a good couple hours this afternoon reading your archives, and it was great.
Oh, you did? Oh, thank you.
Next time I'm going to interview you a little bit.
Well, that's very flattering, Leo. Good.
Well,
we urge our folks at home to buy your book by H.P. Abarelli, Jr., A Terrible Mistake, The Murder of Frank Olson and the CIA's Secret Cold War Experiments. And thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much. I'll talk to you both soon.
Good. We'd love it.
Take care.
Okay. Good night.
Bye-bye.
And, Leo, it's time for a station ID.
All right. This is WQQQ 103.3 FM in Sharon, Lakeville, and Millerton. And you're listening to... Okay. That was last night's program, interview with Frank Abarelli. And if you want more information on his book, you can go to A Terrible Mistake, and is the name of the book. But you can also look up Abarelli, A-B-B-A-R-R-I-L-I, Abarelli, .net. You check that out. But you can also look up A Terrible Mistake or The Death of Frank Olson, and that book will come up. So that's about what we get time for tonight. I mean, we've got a few more minutes. I don't know if there's anything here that I can... Yeah, Tel Aviv is seeking another nuclear plant through Jordan. I find this funny. They won't let Iran build their nuclear plants, but they can make any as they can have as many as they want. It's a sick process. And it does seem to excuse me, I'm sorry. Next Wednesday. But next Tuesday night on our show, which you can pick up at www.com, I'm sorry, wqqq.com, and you can get that, you can pick that up at 8 to 10 o'clock on Tuesday nights. And next week we're going to have a spokeslady for an Iraqi activist, Dr. Wasi, Dalia Wasi, I believe her name is Wasi, and she's a very, very strong advocate for the rights of Iraqis, human rights activist, and she will talk about the atrocities that are happening in Iraq and the problems with no electricity, no heat, no cooking oil, no gas, no anything. No water, and those are all current conditions and problems and reconstruction that never happened and monies that have just been wasted. And we'll have her on her interview on next Wednesday, but it'll be live on Tuesday night and at on WQQ
barbecue.com at 8 to 10 o'clock. And I'm going to play out tonight. I've just found this Universal Soldier here, and I'll see if that if it plays well. Hopefully it does. This was written in 1967 by I forget.
He's 5 foot 2 and he's 6 feet 4. He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. Been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will. Kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA. And he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan, and he thinks we'll put an end to war this way. And he's fighting for democracy, he's fighting for the red, he says it's for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die, and he never sees the writing on the wall. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned him at Laval? Without him, Caesar would have stood alone. He's the one who gives his body as a weapon of the war. And without him, all this killing can't go on. He's a universal soldier, and he really is to blame. His orders come from far away no more. They come from here and there. You and me, and brothers, can't you see? This is not the way we put the end to war.
And that was written by Buffy St. Marie. I forgot. But, yeah. Might as well play another one by Donovan, one I really love, which is Try and Catch the Wind.
In the gray of minutes of uncertainty, I want to be in the warm hall of your love and mine. To feel you all around me and to take your hand along. Ah, but I may as well try and catch the wind. When sundown pales the sky, I want to hide a while behind your smile. And everywhere I'd look your eyes I'd find. For me to love you now would be the sweetest thing, 'twould make me sing. Ah, but I may as well try and catch the wind. When rain has hung the leaves with tears, so I kill my fears, to help me to leave all my blues behind. Standing in your heart is where I want to be and long to be. Ah, but I may as well try and catch the wind.
That ends our show for tonight, and that was Donovan's Catch the Wind. And I want to thank everybody for joining us. We hope that you will join us again tomorrow when we discuss the spiritual world. So Hope you have
your
a good
home
time.
Sees a lot of life, and so does new Air and Eye Motion. It's the only continuous.